Hello everybody, it's Chris here. I hope you're well. Today we are sharing an episode of Extra Shot, which actually came out last week. So this is a taster of the Patreon-only show that follows every episode of Espresso Martini. We're sharing this today for two reasons. Number one, Matt and I are actually quite busy at the moment going through interviews for season 9. So we're actually recording 3 interviews over the next few days that will be part of the beginnings of season 9. So we're a little bit behind schedule in some ways and don't have anything available for this week just due to availability of guests and people's schedules. But season 9 is underway. As I mentioned before, we're slowly moving our productions with a video side, which you at the moment can see on Patreon, but should be available. We're going to start releasing our videos out on YouTube sort of next week, latter part of next week, because the YouTube channel, as I mentioned before, has been a little bit neglected, and I apologize about that. And we're just sort of catching up the old projects before we start releasing the kind of current ones, because I don't want the YouTube channel to become a mess. So we're just sorting out the YouTube channel, getting it ready. And then you'll be able to see our video content. And I've just today come off recording our first ever studio shoots, and I was joined by Julian Fisher, and we'll talk about his book Thinking Like a Spy, and we had a really great chat. And so that will be out in a few weeks' time. So we've got some really interesting guests coming up. I don't like to say in advance who they are, just in case things change at the last minute, because sometimes they do. But yeah, Matt and I are working on a very exciting new season, and we're looking forward to sharing all the new interviews with you. And last bit as well, so we've had some wonderful feedback on the survey. I'm going to be closing the survey at the end of Monday the 24th of September, so you've still got the weekend to leave results if you wish to. We've had an awful lot of feedback that's been incredibly useful, and a lot of it has been very complimentary, which is always very nice. And we've had some very constructive kind of points as well that we're taking on board, and our plan is just to bear all those points in mind as we go on with season 9 and beyond, and hopefully make the podcast even better than it is currently, which is always our goal. We always want every episode to be better than the previous one, and some sort of, you know, we're always trying to find ways to improve things. So yeah, we really appreciate your feedback. It was really useful, and we will be making some incremental changes over time. So without further ado, this is last week's Extra Shot. And just as a reminder, Extra Shot is our special show for Patreon subscribers that goes out immediately after an Espresso Martini. It's a little bit looser, so Matt and I talk a little bit at the beginning about how we're feeling, etc., and talk a little bit about our summers and things. So it's a looser show, a little bit more personal, but we do go through relevant stories, and we hope you enjoy it. And if you wish to become a Patreon subscriber, just go to patreon.com/secretsandspies, and you'll be able to directly support the podcast through there. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll catch you next week. Take care. Everybody, and welcome to Extra Shot. If you're listening to this, you're directly supporting our show, so thank you very much for that. Matt, I think we had pretty good episodes. Nice returning.
It was nice to come back. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
How was your summer break in the end? Was it all right?
It was fine. Wasn't too much of a break. I mean, I still had a lot of work to do with the various other projects I've had unfinished for quite a few years, to my great shame. So, you know, some of that stuff working here and there still, but It was nice, you know. Not I didn't really have like a vacation so much. I don't know. So I'm down in Florida for the week for listeners. I don't know if we're gonna show any of the video here, but it looks very tropical behind me. I'm gonna try this week, I think. I got a couple things I need to get done. This was on the schedule. Then I got another thing I got to handle. And then I think the rest of the time I'm here, I might try to just chill by the pool and read a bit. Also stuff for this show, but still reading it by a pool, which is, you know, a little bit better than usual for me.
Yeah. No, cool. It's important to get that downtime.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, my summer definitely wasn't a break. It was quite busy, actually. Usually August is pretty much a dead month, and I try and purposely engineer everything so very little happens over August, so I can kind of enjoy it, almost a bit like when I was at school, and I've been doing it for about 3 years now, and I've been really benefiting from it. So this year I haven't had that, and I can feel it. Yeah, so I'm going to take a mini break probably late September. But no, honestly, my summer was busy in a positive way. I had this amazing Buddhist retreat that I went to. It was fantastic. And I was on this sort of... so basically, it was at this sort of boarding school that was closed for the summer. And the Buddhist organization had rented it. So we became this little community in the middle of Hampshire. And honestly, it was lovely because you could just walk around the estate every night. You know, there's no feel, you know, it's not like living in a city where sometimes you've got to be a little bit, not on edge, but you just, it's sensible to have, to be alert around you, yeah. Especially in London, petty crime's gone up quite dramatically. People are whipping your phone off you, or some people have had luxury watches taken. Not that I've got a luxury watch to take, but you know, you've got to be a bit, have your wits about you a little bit. And the last thing I want is my phone stolen, but, it's totally the opposite of that in this estate in the middle of nowhere. And it was just so nice. So it kind of was it felt like half a holiday because of the zenness of it. And then obviously still work. But it was just so nice being in the middle of nowhere for a few days. And it was for 6 days. And I might be doing it again next year. So this might become an annual thing for me, which would be great. And then I've been working on this project about dyslexia for a client of mine. And I probably mentioned this before, but I actually have dyslexia. So it's interesting listening to interviews of people of different age groups about their experiences of it. And some things I can relate to. And others are like, oh, okay. You know, so it's been a bit of an introspective summer a little bit, because I've been like, oh my goodness, you know, so that was because of that. And oh, you know, and I'm not alone in thinking that. So it was quite interesting. So yeah, so it's been good. But it's nice to be back. I mean, one of the things that I was feeling over August was I've lost track now what has happened, but it was quite a lot going on in August, as always. Yeah.
I know. That's like, so looking
it's
at
like
the
we
outline,
could have done like three or four podcasts.
Looking at the list of stuff we have for this extra shot and espresso martini that we just recorded before this, I was looking at like, okay, do I want to focus on stuff that happened when we were gone, or stuff that's more happening like right now? And I feel like it's hard to strike that balance, because there's definitely some stuff that happened that like we really should touch on, but then there's like it still hasn't slowed down, you know? So it's hard to, it's hard to catch up. I know a lot of, yes, no. Crazy, crazy month.
No, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, let's dive into some of this craziness. So so we're going to look at stochastic terrorism using disgust to fuel violence. Then we're going to peek inside the AP3 militia group in the US, which is a very interesting piece. And then we're going to sort of finish up just sort of pondering on this sort of globally integrated ISIS that's sort of returning or never went, depending on how you look at things. Okay, so we'll kick off with stochastic terrorism using disgust to incite violence. So this is actually a piece from 2022, but I just thought it was an interesting thing to bring back up again.
Yeah.
Because I feel it's still as relevant today, sadly, as it was back then. So this article was by Brian Nelson from the Scientific American, and it's an opinion piece. And so just to summarize, so the article mentions about a week before the midterm elections in 2022, you may remember a man broke into Nancy Pelosi's home and attacked her husband. And this individual had been influenced by conspiracy theories like QAnon that falsely claimed that Democratic leaders are pedophiles. And this reflects a broader trend of rising threats and violence fueled by right-wing media figures, including former President Donald Trump's support for such conspiracy theories, including those targeting the LGBTQ plus community with baseless accusations of grooming. So stochastic terrorism is where hate speech increases the chances of unpredictable violent attacks, and it plays a key role in these acts. So propagandists exploit emotions like disgust to dehumanize marginalized groups, as seen as seen throughout history with Jewish, Black, and LGBTQ plus people. The COVID-19 pandemic also has fueled racism, xenophobia, and homophobia, worsening the spread of conspiracy theories and inciting violence. Media figures like Tucker Carlson have amplified these harmful ideas, linking drag queens and the LGBTQ plus advocates to pedophilia, further escalating threats to those individuals. And transgender individuals have become frequent targets for violence, with far-right groups using fear and disgust to incite harm against minorities and educators and public officials. And this tactic of stirring disgust is used in political campaigns to manipulate voters by demoralizing marginalized communities. Efforts to counteract this cycle include de-radicalization programs, community interventions, and promoting empathy and trust. Legal measures against hate speech and violence could help reduce the spread of extremism, reducing engagement with media platforms that thrive on stoking fear and disgust is essential in breaking the cycle of vilification and restoring decency and shared humanity. So you can see, I feel like you can see why we brought this up, because what we've just been talking about, you know, this is sort of the thread that kind of goes through, I think, what's wrong with social media today and, you know, with YouTube, etc. Is yeah. That kind of hateful, dehumanizing content is the thing that is just the lifeblood of the internet at the moment, because again, it's sensationalist and it drives people in, and some people take it seriously, some people find it amusing and share it around, but it's and some people may watch it ironically, who knows, but it's very serious stuff and really shouldn't be taken as a joke, and you know, it's led to real world violence, as we've seen. So that's why I brought this up. So Matt, I don't know if you had any thoughts on this piece.
Yeah, I was really glad that you brought this up. I think Bryn would be a good guest on the show for you.
Yeah.
Not to be your assignment editor or anything here.
It's all right.
It's been a persistent and in some ways a growing problem, certainly born of, social media, like we talked about in reference to the failed ISIS attack on the Taylor Swift concert. Vienna, how social media is, these algorithms are sort of just constructed to reward extremism and to sort of push like our worst demons out on people who are not necessarily looking for it, right? Like it serves it to them, whether they're necessarily predisposed to it or not, right? And in some cases, you know, certain people are, and they fall down the rabbit hole. And I think there's a really good example of this stochastic terrorism happening right now. So over the last, you know, week or so, there's been this story that sort of bubbled up in right-wing media spaces about Haitian migrants in this town in Springfield, Ohio. Yes. Has this gotten over there very much? Have you guys?
Yeah. It was a soundbite from the debate between President Trump and Kamala, Vice President Harris.
So there's this, I don't quite know its origin, and to be honest, I don't really care, but it bubbled up in right-wing media spheres, you know, pushed by people like Elon Musk and Ted Cruz and J.D. Vance, that this unsubstantiated story that Haitian migrants in this town, Springfield, Ohio, were, going into people's yards and stealing their dogs and cats, or, you know, pulling geese out of, you know, lakes and ponds and stuff in the area and, like, eating them. Mm. And of course, using this to, you know, smear Democrats for the, you know, migrant crisis that we have here in the U.S. It's been totally unsubstantiated. So this came up at the debate. Trump brought it up and said that, you know, he saw it on TV. He was fact checked.
That makes it true.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, for the I saw it on. Yeah,
where did he see it on TV?
And he was fact checked by the moderators, who said that that ABC News reached out to the city manager of Springfield, Ohio, and said that there's no real truth to this at all. There is an instance of a woman in Springfield, Ohio, who ate a cat. You know, which is really kind of gross and disgusting, of course. But she was a U.S. citizen. Everyone in her house was a U.S. citizen who was known to law enforcement in the area. She had mental health and issues with drugs and stuff. So this is a mental health, a drug issue of a woman who is clearly mentally ill and did something like this, right? Not Haitian migrants, you know, pulling people's pets out of their yards and eating them. But this got traction. J.D. Vance was, you know, called out on it and everything, and basically said, yeah, okay, keep doing the memes anyway. Keep doing like the memes anyway, and this totally kind of post-truth world that they live in now. And I don't know if you saw this, just as we were sitting down to record, I got a news alert. The City Hall in Springfield was evacuated. Someone emailed in bomb threats to it this morning.
Oh, good grief.
So
I didn't see that.
This is exactly what we're talking about, you know. And as far as like the whole, I mean, yes, that someone would react that way to it is certainly born of the disgust that these false stories want to spread amongst peoples. And it's something is deeply personal to me. I don't know how many listeners know I'm part of the LGBTQ community. I mean, of course, I'm somewhat in a way, I think I'm very lucky because I'm not trans. I don't look or sound like, you know, Randy Rainbow. And if you just saw me out there, you would, or even listen to me here every episode before even, you know, cutting out the parts where I've mentioned this, you probably wouldn't ever know. You know, but there have been instances where I've been, you know, out in public and are really hesitant to do things or act in a certain way that, I mean, frankly, you, Chris, would never think twice about, you know, because I don't know who's within view or whatever. And, you know, has been fed this diet of bullshit that, you know, gay people are, you know, groomers and pedophiles and sexualizing children, and would see me do something that would be very clear of what my sexuality is now, and then be attacked for it. And that's something that, you know, people who aren't on the receiving end of this stuff will never have to deal with. So it is very real, and it's something that I will tell listeners absolutely impacts someone in your everyday life, even if you're not entirely sure about it or they haven't brought it up to you. I promise you, you know someone who this touches.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry it does affect you in that way. We, you know, you sometimes like to think that the world has moved on and got better over certain issues, and sadly then, you know, we go through what we go through, and you realize that actually this world is not much better than when you thought it was supposed to be improved upon. And you know what you're saying there, like, you know, basically a simple act of being able to hold your partner's hand in public could cost you your life.
Yeah.
And that's terrible.
Yeah. And it's something that I think that people don't have to face that reality ever. It's not something you would ever really think of. I mean, why would you consider it's not a reality that you, I mean, thankfully ever have to deal with, but this is the shit that causes it for people like me and people who are a lot less lucky than me, who don't necessarily have the ability to, we'll say, like, hide. You know, I can hide. There's a lot of people who can't.
Yeah, no, indeed. You know, all this just takes me back to a photograph I took in 2004. So when I was studying photography, I was, you know, you do these random photo projects, and one of them was to sort of do street photography. And I was in the Waterloo area, And there's a tree that I still see to this day. And when I photographed it, it had flowers all around it. And basically, there had been a hate crime that had led to murder. And it was a hate crime directed at a gay man. Mm-hmm. And he was murdered on that spot. And yeah. That tree still stands today. I can still picture it when I walk past it. And I've got the photograph in my sort of archives and all that. And yeah, it's just a horrible reality that really we should have moved on from by now, but we haven't. And yeah. It makes me very sad.
I think there's a lot of the people who push this stuff out. One, I think it's cowardly to just hide behind the power of suggestion, to not just outright say, yeah, go ahead and do this stuff, but to sort of keep that plausible deniability, even as sort of transparent as it is to the rest of us under the law, there is still plausible deniability there. And they're able to sort of hide behind the rights and privileges and protections that they would just as easily take away from people like me. There's an air of, they act like it's a joke or it's a meme, you know, or it's like this sort of zero sum, the ends justify the means, it's all just politics and stuff. And it's not. There are real people that get affected by this stuff every day. I mean, I've certainly felt it in my own personal life multiple times. And then, you know, it's not just that, it's with, you know, migrants and stuff too. Like you've had this, like I just mentioned, this issue in Springfield, Ohio, just this morning. It was a bomb threat sent into City Hall because of these, you know, just bullshit right-wing conspiracy theories.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. Well, I've always been interested in that sort of multifaceted psychology of hate, because I've always liked to believe that once you know how something works, you're one step kind of closer to being able to provide a solution to it. But I say that being very optimistic. I don't really know what the solution is to dealing with this.
I don't know what it is either.
No, but the psychological aspect of it, obviously an emotional response can bypass your kind of rational mind. And so disgust is a pretty universal kind of, is universal the right word? It's, you know, disgust is something that, you know, it's very basic. That's probably a better word than universal. It's a basic thing. You know, it could be anything really. And seeing how it can be weaponized to dehumanize someone is quite shocking, actually. And that's why this article, I think, is very important. And that's why I wanted to sort of bring it up. So there's not really much else I think I can add to this, but I don't know if there's anything else you want to add to this, but thank you for sharing you have.
No, I think we got it covered for now. Yeah.
Well, let's get out our night vision scopes and go into this militia. Because what a article that was.
Yeah, this is certainly a longer read. It's a great deep dive that ProPublica did into the American Patriots 3% militia.
One question. Sure. Did you manage to get the on that article? I was trying to listen to it and I could never get it to bloody work.
I didn't try that. I don't know if it would work for me or not. I just read it. So I read this.
Yeah, I read it.
I read it on a plane yesterday and I sort of copied and pasted it because I wasn't sure if I would have Wi-Fi on the plane. I ended up did. But I copy and pasted the whole article into my notes app and sort of had it there. So I was just reading it through. So any of the pictures or formatting and stuff, when I read it yesterday, I missed it. It's a long article. I will break it down for listeners as best I can. So bear with me here. There's quite a bit here. So the American Patriots 3% or AP3 militia projects a dual image publicly. It engages in community service like food drives, while privately, members practice paramilitary tactics, including storming buildings with semi-automatic rifles and discussing political violence as an imminent necessity. The January 6th Capitol riot was a critical moment for AP3, serving as both an inspiration for new recruits and a cause for internal dissension. While some viewed the event as a failure that didn't go far enough, it led others to advocate for more extreme action, fearing that political engagement alone could no longer resolve national issues. AP3 has managed to grow after January 6th, despite increased media and law enforcement scrutiny. The group attracts members from diverse backgrounds, including law enforcement, veterans, and civilians, aided by recruitment strategies that utilize Veterans Affairs facilities and social media, despite crackdowns from platforms like Facebook. The group faces significant internal turmoil, with some members growing alarmed by the group's increasing radicalization. The militia's national commander, Scott Seddon, experienced personal and leadership challenges, even contemplating quitting the movement, though he ultimately spearheaded efforts to rebuild the group post-January 6th. Militia members, including AP3, are increasingly vocal about resorting to violence, with leaders predicting that the outcome of future political elections will be decided by the, quote, the ammo box rather than the ballot box. This reflects a broader shift in some militia circles toward embracing violent resistance against the government. AP3 leaders, particularly Seddon, sought to align with police and sheriffs to increase their operational success. This approach involved recruiting officers, cultivating relationships with sheriffs, and portraying AP3 as a community-focused group rather than a militia. Members often fostered connections with police departments, offering joint training sessions and participating in community service events to improve their image. Key figures like Ed Eubanks in Oklahoma strategically ingratiated themselves with law enforcement through events, meet and greets, and intelligence sharing. AP3 deployed members to the U.S.-Mexico border for vigilante-style patrols, collaborating with local sheriffs and sometimes clashing with the National Guard. Despite legal limitations, members were involved in detaining migrants and claimed cooperation with the Border Patrol. Seddon's rhetoric became increasingly extreme, with a growing faction within AP3 advocating for violence, particularly in response to political developments. Members discussed assassinations, a TAC team, and potential mass actions against government institutions. Seddon's credibility crumbled after revelations about his falsified military background. So he claimed to be like this big military hero, and then someone got a hold of his discharge papers, and I think he was in active duty for like 5 months or something. And financial mismanagement through his nonprofit front. As a result, AP3 splintered, with many members defecting to other militias while maintaining their radical mission. AP3's struggles are emblematic of a broader decentralization in the militia movement. Although the group fractured, many former members continue to operate independently or with other organizations, often coordinating through secure messaging apps, and remain committed to anti-government extremist goals. Chris, what'd you think of this one?
Well, quick thing, which messaging app are they using?
I'd have to go back and look at the article. Was it Telegram?
It was Telegram.
It was Telegram. There you go.
Oh man. So yeah. No, very, very interesting and concerning article. And obviously backing up what we were just saying about Telegram earlier. I've got a few random notes here, but I was really interested about how this militia group were doing things like delivering food to the Veterans Center. Yeah. And it looked like they were trying to ingratiate themselves with military veterans who've fallen on hard times. And this is sort of one strategy I've noticed sort of the far right do, and even maybe some sort of extreme political groups of the other tangent as well. But typically far right groups like to focus on something really basic and tangible, which in this situation is supplying food to those in need. So then that individual can be seen as a person of action over words. And if that action is something noble like supplying food, then over time that individual gets seen as sort of charitable, and people tend to kind of forget or overlook the kind of nasty side of their politics, or even maybe start not to believe that this nice man that gives me food really hates a lot of people, you know, he's a really hateful person, or it could be a woman too. So it kind of reminds me a little bit of something gangsters and drug lords do. You know, Al Capone and Pablo Escobar were both very famous for their charitable contributions at a local level, as was the greatest sex offender in UK history, Sir Jimmy Savile, or no longer Sir Jimmy Savile, who was this sort of children's TV presenter who was always involved with charity and managed to become the country's worst ever sex offender. So if you're American and have never heard of Jimmy Savile, you know, you're a lucky person. But he was a massive figure on TV for decades, very famous. Yeah. You know, had audiences with prime ministers, I think met the Queen a few times, etc.
I would think,
but it always was a bit odd.
I would guess most Americans have never heard of Jimmy Savile.
No, yeah. No. And I think there's a Netflix documentary about him, yeah, if you want to find out more. But he was a very strange man hiding in plain sight, but was a lot of the time was very protected because of his charitable status and contributions. And the problem is with those situations, then if you are investigating some individual for something bad, they're kind of seen as, oh, hang on a minute, this is the guy who's raised millions for this cause. So it kind of provides this sort of armor that you've got to be a bit careful about. So not that I'm saying you should be suspicious of people all the time who are charitable, but there are some instances where that might be justified. And then that chilling quote that you brought up earlier about the election won't be decided at the ballot box, it'll be decided by the ammo box. That's really quite disturbing. And yeah, the only thing I suppose that came out a little bit as well in the article was about how January the 6th did appear to be a bit of a wake-up call, both for the security services like the FBI in the States, but also for some of these militia members themselves. And they lost, yep, a lot of membership,
yep,
because suddenly they saw that their kind of, should we say, military cosplaying actually had consequences and that they could go to jail for quite some time and lose their jobs, yep, and stuff. And I think for some people, the risk was not worth it. And I think you've said this before as well about like the people talk about we're going to have a civil war and do this, that and the other. But the second they realize they're about to lose their Netflix privileges, they kind of retreat, yeah, a little bit. And I think with Seldon, he sort of saw all this and sort of felt quite disenchanted. But then worryingly, like a sort of new generation of people came to the group who'd seen January the 6th and really fired up and wanted more. And that if anything, they're more concerning. But I like to think because this is an article that we're reading in a paper that the FBI, etc., probably very much aware of what's going on and hopefully doing their best to kind of sort out individuals like this. But it was also the other interesting thing in the article as well was about like how Seldon and his group were trying to making a very concerted effort to win over local law enforcement kind of at the sheriff level. And in some cases, they appeared to be successful. And in other cases, they weren't. But there was this sort of spreadsheet that they mentioned that they'd created to list all the sheriffs, etc., by name and then put next their name, whether they were kind of like a Republican and whether they might be friendly or not. That was, you know, people, I was saying earlier, these extremist groups are quite intelligent. You know, you should never take them as idiots or anything like that. But one other thing that kind of stood out as well was Seldon, people like Seldon do tend to be these people who are trying to fill a void in their lives. And yeah, it sounds to me like when you look at he hadn't done very well in his kind of, you know, he was going from one career to another, one job, yeah, to another, hadn't succeeded in the military, but was sort of trying to trade off this sort of macho image. And the line that really was a bit sort of sad, but also at the same time really showed the void he's in, was he often recorded his video directives to his troops from his car whilst driving between deliveries for Uber Eats.
I have it in my notes too. I was gonna mention that. That's rough.
Yeah. Imagine if you put that in your novel. I just don't think people would believe it.
It would be comical. It would be, yeah, this sort of slapstick, yeah, like Keystone Cop sort of thing. It would be very it would really depend on how you frame it and where you go with the character later, you know, but that, yeah, like, you know, cut screen, I guess, if you want to, yeah, call it, or like you have he's like looking in the camera, recording these orders, these marching orders and stuff to his, you know, far right militia members, like this, essentially like this domestic terror group, in waiting, and then like you zoom out and like he's waiting to pick up something at like McDonald's for his Uber Eats delivery. Like it's kind of ridiculous if it just wasn't so potentially just, yeah, real and just dangerous, you know.
No, it's crazy, isn't it? And what was the other thing? The other note I was going to say was the other interesting thing with these far right militias is that in many cases their downfall tends to be because of the ego of whoever their figurehead is, and members getting cold feet after a proper brush with the law. So, very, very interesting piece. And I'll hand it back to you just in case you had any other sort of thoughts.
I mean, you spoke to sort of the weird sort of complexities I found around Seddon and just sort of who he is. And like, as you said, just sort of lost. And that bit about him, you know, running this militia between Uber Eats orders really just sort of knocked me off my feet. Like, wow, man, this is where we are.
Yeah.
Something else I noticed really also was that, like, how January 6th, drew a lot of members away from the movement, you know, where they saw like, oh, I'm not actually a domestic terrorist. You know, I'm not for, you know, actually like going to war with the federal government here. I have a life and a job and like, I can't be a part of this. Let me melt back into society and just sort of maybe, you know, quietly support it from afar. There's also then it attracted new people. You know, one of the things that I thought of was that quote from Heat from Tom Sizemore's character, like, for me, the action is the juice. You know, that's who became attracted to this stuff after January 6th. And I think that is potentially really dangerous. The other sort of point I thought of, I mean, I've thought for a long time, I think we've discussed it here, in the eventuality that Trump loses in November, and right now, you know, sitting here on September 12th, it's close. It's not a done deal. It's not decided, but a lot of trend lines suggest that that's going to happen right now, thankfully. And I hope it stays that way. You know, what do these people do in that eventuality? I mean, I think for much of the far right or the right wing sort of space that has become radicalized in the last decade that Trump has been sort of like the main character of the American right. Right. This election is kind of their last attempt to gain power through the political system by participating in it, you know, and
for now.
And when that doesn't pan out the way they want it to, right, where do they go? You know, where else? You saw 2020 COVID, January 6th as this deeply radicalizing event for them. Donald Trump losing and then finally facing justice in his various criminal trials and stuff will be another radicalizing event for them. And I wonder, where else do they have to go but violence? Where else is there? I don't know. And I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of them that, you know, when you get faced with the reality of, you know, being a domestic terrorist and going to war with the federal government, that, you know, there's a lot of rationality in being like, whoa, maybe not for me, and I'll just, you know, yell about it on Facebook. But there's some people who for them, the action is the juice, and I don't know where else they go. And I think we're gonna, I think you'll see it between the election and the inauguration. You know, I don't think it'll be as sort of like big and organized. Part of that is because Donald Trump won't control the executive branch of the federal government this time around. But there's a lot of, you know, little smaller nuisances in at the state and local level, certainly with these sheriffs. You know, they talk a lot about how this group has done a lot of outreach to sheriff organizations, and there's this part of the ideology of the far right. A lot of them think that in the U.S. that the county sheriff is the only constitutionally allowed level of law enforcement, right? Like, it's the sheriff and that's it. Anything else above that is unconstitutional and we don't need to pay attention to it, right? And I think that's why a lot of them really focus on these sheriff movements. And that ideology has been received very sympathetically by a lot of sheriffs all around the country. And I just think there's, I don't know, like, there was that in looking at, like, at the start of the war on terror after 9/11 and everything, people use the analogy of like, when the Soviet Union collapsed, we defeated this dragon, and now we're in this room with a bunch of different poisonous snakes, right? And I really sort of see that potentially being kind of a similar situation where, you know, with Trump off the scene, you know, now potentially after November, that dragon has been defeated, but now there's going to be a bunch of other smaller poisonous snakes. And I think there's potential for a real, like I said, I don't think like civil war, because like we've said before, people want to turn on their light switch and have the lights come on, or turn the faucet and have water come out. So I don't think we really want that. But there's a lot of potential for a lot lower level political violence. I would go back to the example that I think is really potentially useful for people to look at when imagining what this would be like, would be the Troubles in Northern Ireland through the 70s. Like this sustained period of sort of low level political violence in the background that is tacitly or even overtly accepted by a portion of the population and political leaders. I think that's something that was probably what it would look something like would be the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And these guys would be, you know, playing that same role that like the IRA or any other number of loyalist militias did.
What is it? Yeah, vans parked strategically full of Semtex. City of London, etc., have suffered from that over the years. Totally. David Nywert, who was a former guest in this show, I must try and get him back on because he's actually written an article based on that very scenario you've just talked about.
About the Troubles?
Not about the Troubles, but about the rise in political violence should Trump lose.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting piece that probably we should have talked about actually, but in back of my mind I was thinking I'll just get him on, so
I must do that
because he's a very interesting guy. He's a leading expert on sort of the far right and stuff. And what was my second thought there? I had another one. In a weird way, unfortunately in America you kind of already do live with mass violence almost on a daily basis already because of these mass shootings you get. They may or may not be politically motivated, but you already do sadly live in a situation where that has become normalized. And, you know, we've only had a few mass shootings in this country and it's led to huge political change. I mean, like the Dunblane massacre that happened in 1996, if I remember correctly, led to a ban of handguns in the UK. And then prior to that, we had the Hungerford massacre in the 80s, which led to the banning of, I think, automatic rifles. So we're very lucky that we've had, you know, probably less than I can stick on a single hand. Could be wrong there, but it's definitely under 10 come to mind, probably under 5, to be honest. But we're very lucky in that regard. Very, very difficult sort of situation. I'm not sure what else I could add to that, but I thought it was a really good piece. So thank you for sharing that with us. I don't know if you have any sort of other thoughts on this piece at all.
Just an interesting thing to keep an eye on. I think these groups are terrorist groups in all but name. I mean, you see the way they're organizing, like the Hezbollah, for example, they're a terrorist group. They're not just a bunch of men with guns and missiles and stuff. They also run schools and hospitals and charities and construction firms and stuff. And you see and have allied themselves with, Lebanese legitimate Lebanese political authorities. And I think you see those same trends happening here. I think these are terrorist groups in all but name, and they're just sort of waiting for that sort of inciting moment to really go off the deep end. And I wonder where they go once Trump is not coming back and they need to find a new Lord and Savior, because this one isn't rising from the dead. I wonder what they do with that.
Yeah. It did cross my mind because obviously a lot of these groups lost their shit over the fact that Obama was a black man and Kamala Harris being a black woman.
Great point.
It does make you wonder how people are going to react to that.
Yeah.
You know, it did cross my mind the other day. I was just like, I don't know. It's sort of, I'm really hopeful for your elections, but at the same time, there's so many dark aspects to both positive and negative outcomes. It's just like,
it's sort of, in many ways, I think looking past November is sort of like with whatever happens, it's sort of like looking past the event horizon. You know, you cannot possibly predict what will come. You can't, or at least you can't know for sure. I don't know. Yeah.
No. Well, I only know of one man who thinks he knows for sure what's happening, but there we go. And who is that man?
Is that a Alan Lookman plug? Or
it is Alan Lookman. Yeah. Well, Alan Lookman's the only man who seems to believe.
Alan Lookman has a prediction of what's going to happen with that election, not necessarily what's going to come after it.
Oh, true. Right. True. Yeah. Indeed. And Alan Lichtman's given me a lot of hope, but we'll see what happens. Yeah. fingers crossed that definitely his 40-year track record continues as it is.
Definitely.
Wow. Moving on to one of our last cheery topic for the day. So our last cheery topic of the day, we've got a globally integrated Islamic State. And this is a piece from War on the Rocks by Aaron Y. Zelen. I might say it's a piece from War on the Rocks by Aaron Y. Zelen. So this piece starts with, the Islamic State today operates as a more integrated and resilient global network than Al-Qaeda ever was, with its central organization connected to various provinces worldwide. This marks a shift from its previous focus on territorial control in Iraq and Syria. IS has adapted its leadership structure with greater involvement of provinces outside Iraq and Syria, and the general director of provinces we mentioned before is now central to coordinating governance with foreign fighter mobilization and external operations, and potentially with its leadership hub in Somalia, which is quite an interesting thing that may come back to in a bit. Despite shifting global attention to other issues such as China and Russia, IS remains a significant and evolving threat. Policymakers must avoid underestimating its current organizational strength, which could lead to repeated misinterpretations and policy failures. The Islamic State's external operations have evolved into a more resilient, globally coordinated network, and rather than being in a single controlled province, it's in many places and many regions now. Those include, it allows for a broader scope of attacks, which includes various regions, including Iran, Turkey, and Russia, as well as ongoing recruitment efforts online. And interestingly, Turkey has become a central hub for Islamic State operations, serving as a node for recruitment, attack planning, and financing schemes. Arrests and disruptive plots in countries like Germany and Russia further emphasize Turkey's role in facilitating global Islamic State activities, including those tied to foreign fighter networks and money laundering schemes. The Islamic State's current model, which no longer depends on territorial control, presents a new challenge for global counterterrorism efforts. Its integrated and adaptive networks across multiple provinces requires a different approach, as traditional methods used against the group in Iraq and Syria may not be as effective in other regions, particularly in Africa and Central Asia. So, Matt, I don't know if you have any thoughts on all of this.
I've wanted to get Aaron on the podcast for a while now to talk about the Islamic State and sort of what its next chapter will be. Definitely in this season, that's one that I want to do. That's an episode I want to do. We have the tools, the resources, the playbook within JSOC and our intelligence agencies to sort of hack away at the org charts of organizations like this. We got very good at deleting terrorists over the last, 3 years as of yesterday. So it's not something we can't do again. I think the important thing then is the difference now is, I think one of the reasons that we have difficulties that we have today in terms of with Russia and China is because for the last 23 years, we were sort of entirely focused on these terrorist groups. And that's not, that's not the wealth of the geopolitical challenges we face. Russia and China are now still, and others are now very real challenges as well. So we cannot put horse blinders on and just focus on these terrorist groups. It's interesting to see what sort of the second act of what ISIS will look like. We mentioned in Espresso Martini how just this messaging is able to radicalize teenagers in Austria to potentially go attack a Taylor Swift concert and try to kill thousands of people. So this is a very serious thing. I also would be to flag as a potential concern, there's a possibility that in 2026, so we have a status of forces agreement with the Iraqi government, which sort of governs the legal ability of us to have that remnant force within Iraq, right? That we brought back in, I think it's starting in 2014, right? When ISIS controlled territory as large as Britain, right? We defeated that. There's still groups there. They're not there just to sort of keep an eye on ISIS in the area. I think they've, in the last year, they've become really useful in sort of combating some of the Iranian proxies. But there's a potential when this comes up to be negotiated again. And I think, 2026, I believe, that will have to, U.S. forces will have to leave Iraq entirely, which means we'll probably also have to leave Syria, because that footprint in Iraq helps us logistically support those forces in Syria. And that's going to leave, a vacuum on the map where these groups can sort of organize and flourish again. It's an issue. I go back to, again, we know how to, we are very good, like I said, within JSOC and the intelligence community, very good at picking apart these networks. We just can't let it be the all-encompassing focus of our foreign policy for the next, 20 years. 'Cause it's just not like, it's not all there is. We got a lot of other concerns as well, whether that's China or Russia or climate or any number of things.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I think there is a danger that as America shifts its focus to Russia and China, ISIS could become ignored and forgotten, which would be
that's
a big mistake.
And yeah, it's balancing.
And we've seen it happen the other way around. So when the war on terror kicked off in the early 2000s, threats from Russia and China were significantly ignored as the focus went on to Al-Qaeda, right, and then the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and providing intelligence for those. You know, most of the former CIA people we've spoken to were either in Afghanistan or Iraq at some point or another in their career. And it has led to, you know, what's going on with Russia assassinating people across the, Europe, etc. So we've got to be really careful. And it just sometimes tends to be a tendency of politicians to just sort of focus just on one or two things and not see the national security threat as a much bigger picture, and especially members of the public too.
Yep.
You know, I remember many elections ago, I think it was 2010 or 11, 2010, when Nick Clegg, who was then running as the leader of the Liberal Democrat Party, said something on the lines of, we don't need a deterrent at sea anymore. We don't need Trident because the real threat's from terrorism.
Well, that's...
And it's like, yeah.
Also, you know, there was...
So single-minded.
Yeah, there was that famous example of in Obama's debate in 2012 with Romney. Romney said something to the effect of that, you know, Russia was our greatest geopolitical foe. And he said this at the time where... Dmitry Medvedev was president, sort of keeping the seat warm between Putin's first two terms. And then when he came back, it just was a full on dictator at that point.
Even Putin needs a break.
Right. And, or he wasn't able to entirely, you know, reshape the Russian political system to just keep him in power in perpetuity yet. Mm. And, he was laughed at by Obama and sort of the entire like U.S. political establishment, you know, like the 20th century want their politics back. And Romney was entirely correct to have said that. You know, he's been completely proven right in the years since. I think it was only 2 years later that Crimea was invaded by the Russians. So it's true. We sort of have this trend to want to sort of hyper focus on one geopolitical big bad at a time, and we just don't have that luxury. So that's why I go back to my main point here. We definitely know how to counter threats like this. We've gotten very good at it in the last 23 years, but we don't have the luxury to focus entirely on it. There's other issues too that are very different.
Yeah, indeed. And just as I was reading this today, I saw the Soufan Center just sent out an email. I don't know if you've seen it today, but it was talking about how they've got a report on how Germany is facing an uptick of ISIS-inspired terrorism. So the examples they mentioned: on the 5th of September, an 18-year-old Austrian national named Emrah I, who had Bosnian roots, was shot dead by police in a shootout outside the Israeli consulate in Munich. Apparently it was armed with an antique gun that also had a bayonet attached to it. And the incident happened to take place on the 52nd anniversary of the Munich Olympic terrorist attack, in which Black September took members of his the Israeli athletics team hostage and then later killed them in cold blood as police tried to stop them from escaping at Munich airport. Then on the following day, a 29-year-old Albanian citizen went into a police station in a town of called Linz and shouted Allah Akbar whilst vocalizing his intent to kill police officers. And he was swiftly dealt with. And then earlier, on the 23rd of August, there was this terrible knife attack during, ironically or not, the Festival of Diversity, which was an event in a town called Zulingen, which is a German town. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Zulingen. And three people were killed and eight people were injured. And the attack was later claimed by the Islamic State on its news site, Amak. And the perpetrator had apparently targeted Christians who, and the attacker was a soldier of the Islamic State seeking to avenge Muslims in Palestine and elsewhere. And the man responsible for that attack was a Syrian man known named as Ali H. And he was arrested along with a 15-year-old boy who was arrested for having prior knowledge of the attack. And these sort of attacks sadly fuel far-right narratives in the West. And one thing I'd like to just point out, when I once spoke with I've spoken with many terrorism experts, but one in particular once said to me that terrorist attacks fueling far-right narratives are exactly what ISIS wants.
Yep.
They want to push ordinary Muslims and non-Muslims to the extremes so that they can benefit from Muslims who turn to them for protection. And so, you know, unfortunately, ISIS, etc., do weaponize the use of foreign nationals for their aims, and they kind of do it on purpose to fuel these far-right narratives. And I think people need to be aware of that and temper their reactions to such things. And it's sad that they picked that Festival of Diversity to do this knife attack, but at the same time, you can kind of see how that is the perfect target, because then you get the right-wing press the next day saying, look at this Festival of Diversity, immigrant killed these people. You know, you can always write the headline yourself, and it's, you know, and these terrorist groups are not stupid, so that was probably by design. So, you know, one, I don't think it helps matters by falling into far-right narratives. And so, you know, I just like to remind our lovely audience out there that, you know, got to be a bit careful about those kind of things. But yeah, I think that is probably the cheery note to wrap up on, unless there's anything else you want to add.
Cheery couple episodes today.
Yeah.
Hopefully it doesn't set the tone for the rest of the season, but I don't know. It probably will. Yeah. Knowing what we talk about here. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we're moving into fall or autumn in the UK, which to me is really traditional espionage weather. For me, it gets dark and moody, you know, start to wear longer coats and you know, the sun sets earlier. And I just feel more comfortable in the shadows during that time. So, and I'm sure a lot of bad people do too.
Hibernating. Yeah.
Oh dear. So I think it probably will be a dark and moody season for a while. We'll try and make sure there's the odd light-hearted episode where we can. It's been a good to get back into things, and I hope we haven't caused you nightmares or anything else. Oh dear. But there we go. So Matt, do you have any interesting plans for the weekend?
I'm going to be in Florida for the rest of the week here. So, got a lot of reading I want to do. I'm just going to be hanging out. There's a pool, sort of a very short walk. I can actually look at it right over there, over that way. So I will hopefully spend a lot of time there.
Yeah, no, fantastic. Yeah. I think my plan is to just find the name of the movie a second, so I've completely forgotten it. I'm about to see this film called Lee, which is about the war photographer, and so I'll be seeing that over the weekend. I'm looking forward to that, and I'll probably be doing my usual round of cooking, etc.
Cool.
A bit of editing, and hopefully I'm gonna try and sneak in a pumpkin spice latte this weekend, as we're now officially in that season. So
it's I sort of once we get past September, I sort of allow it. I'll stop. I won't. I mean, you can get it here in the U.S. and like by like mid August now, a lot of places have it, which to me is just crazy. Like, there's no way.
Yeah.
Yeah. But by September, yeah, especially when the humidity kind of cools off, it's still humid where I am. It's no different. But,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it's a bit more acceptable, I guess. Yeah.
No, definitely. Well, we have a short window in the UK unless they've changed it, but they stopped selling it after Halloween and they moved to their Christmas drinks. So, okay. So there's only a very sort of window of mid-August to the end of October to grab a pumpkin spice latte.
Yeah.
At least in the UK. I can't speak for America.
I'm not sure when they kick over the Christmas stuff at like Starbucks and everything. I want to say it's a little bit. It's definitely before Thanksgiving. I don't know if it's right after Halloween, though. But, yeah.
No. Well, there we go. Cool. Well, thank you very much for your time, Matt. It's been great. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And don't forget, if you haven't taken part in the survey, I'll put a link to it in the notes on here as well. But, you know, huge thank you for your support on Patreon. You know, you help keep this show going. And, you know, we wouldn't be here without your support. So thank you very much for supporting us on Patreon.
Thanks.
And take care, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Bye.